Garrick Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Robert Knight. He's the founder of the Howard T. Odom Florida Springs Institute, a nonprofit corporation dedicated to supporting science and education necessary for restoration and wise management of Florida's artesian springs. Dr. Knight is an environmental scientist with more than 40 years of professional experience, including detailed ecological studies at many of Florida's large artesian springs. He's former adjunct professor at the University of Florida Department of Environmental Engineering and Sciences, where he taught graduate level classes on the ecology of Florida springs. As director of the Florida Springs Institute, Dr. Knight is active in research and restoration efforts at the Santa Fe River Springs, Kings Bay Crystal River Springs, the Itchitookni Springs, I'll have to say it correctly, Rainbow Springs, Wakula Springs, Homosassa Springs, Glen Springs, Springs of the Suwannee River, Wakiva River Springs, Volusia Blue Spring, and Silver Springs. He's also an advisor to springs advocacy groups throughout North Florida that help educate local government officials about improved groundwater management and springs protection. He is the author of Silent Springs, Moving from Tragedy to Hope. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So just can you start by telling me a little bit about the Florida Springs Institute?
Sure. The Florida Springs Institute is a nonprofit corporation in Florida. I founded it in 2010. I did my doctoral research in the 1970s at Silver Springs, and then was hired later as an environmental consultant to study springs for the state of Florida. They had a Florida Springs Initiative starting in 1999, and it lasted for 10 years. I was a consultant helping out with a lot of those projects. The state decided to stop funding for springs in 2010. So I started the Florida Springs Institute. By that time, I had studied enough of the springs to know that across the board, they were in trouble in various ways. Their health was declining and their beauty was declining, and that they needed a voice, a nonprofit voice, basically, to do the research on them and to continue the work that the state of Florida had been doing previously, and to then document the changing health and educate people about that, try to raise awareness in the public.
So can you provide us with an introduction to Florida Springs ecology? I think that a lot of people may have no idea what that even means and what is special about the region's spring ecology.
Sure. Thank you for that question. Florida is blessed with a limestone platform. The whole state is over a limestone platform that was formed starting 30 million years ago in a tropical sea. And that limestone is thousands of feet thick, and much of its range. It extends over 100,000 square miles, including a large part of Georgia and South Carolina, and even into Alabama and Mississippi. But it's under all of Florida. Limestone is soluble in a slight acid. And whenever ocean levels were low enough for rain to be falling on this limestone platform, it was dissolving and it was forming basically the Swiss cheese that we think of in terms of a limestone aquifer. It was forming tunnels, caves, cavities, and flow capacity so that under the current period of lowered sea levels and Florida being out of the ocean, not covered by the ocean, this limestone is now a drinking water aquifer for all of the southeast United States. It's called Floridan Aquifer, and it holds trillions of gallons of water. It's highly purified water because it was derived from rainfall that was falling over the land, filtering through a sandy layer that's over all of Florida, and then directly into the limestone, where it was captured and retained as a underground aquifer. And we know that an aquifer is any groundwater source that's basically has enough flow to be used as a water supply. So springs are just occur any place where groundwater comes to the land surface. And this limestone is, like I said, it's riddled with caves, and springs are actually former sinkholes where there's enough pressure in the aquifer to push water out of the aquifer naturally, just based on differences in elevation between the middle of the state and the coastal regions of the state. Those springs are putting out a tremendous volume of water because Florida has one of the highest rainfall rates, averaging about 52 inches a year. And there's a lot of recharge. There's about maybe 12 to 15 billion gallons a day of average recharge into the aquifer. And that's why we have these springs.
So first, a sort of simple question and a more complex question. The simple question is, what are the size of a lot of these springs? I mean, are we talking about tiny little seeps, or are we talking about sort of a full-blown river emerging suddenly? And then the second question is, can you talk about, I know this is a lot to cover, but can you talk about the ecology, what is unique about the biotic community associated with that, starting underground? Because this is something, at some point I would love to do an interview with somebody about aquifers as natural communities, because people talk about them as water sources, but I've never spoken with somebody about the beings who actually live in the aquifer itself, even if we go down to bacteria and fungi. Anyway, so can you start, first off, size generally of these springs? And then second, can you sort of move us from underground up to the surface and the river flowing in terms of biotic communities? Are those questions clear?
Yes, very clear. Thank you. Good questions. Florida has the largest concentration of artesian springs anywhere in the world, definitely in the United States. We maybe don't know in the Arctic jungles, but we have over 1,090 artesian springs. And artesian springs are springs that are actually pressurized springs that have a boil when the water comes out of the ground, because the water is under pressure from rainfall recharge at higher elevations. You talked about seeps. We have millions of seeps in Florida. Basically, you get a seepage spring anytime there's a hill and there's rain on the top of the hill, and there'll frequently be a seep at the bottom of the hill where the water hits an impervious layer and then runs out of the seepage spring. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about artesian springs. In the aquifer, if you put a pipe into the aquifer, even without a spring there, if you're in an area of high enough pressure in the aquifer, that pipe, water will flow out of that pipe. It's called a flowing well or an artesian well. But these springs are artesian. So the size, like I said, we have the largest collection of these springs, over 1,090 documented, probably several hundred more of these large springs. But we also have the highest number of large springs of any place in the world and in the United States. We have about 34 first magnitude springs, which are springs that average over 64 million gallons a day of flow. 64 million gallons a day of flow. That's enough water for a very large city. And we have a lot of those springs. Those springs, in turn, create rivers. That water, when it comes out of the ground, has to go somewhere, and it flows downhill, as water typically does, and flows usually into a river or forms a river by itself. And we have numerous spring-fed rivers that are dominated by spring flow. The Silver River, two Withlacoochee Rivers, the Suwannee River, even the St. John's River is dominated by spring flow, or was historically. So just in terms of size and number, we have the largest springs, the most springs, and they're incredible cultural history of humanity living in Florida. We're finding now that people have been in Florida for over 20,000 years based on recent archaeological research. So that is just the sort of the magnitude of the springs. These are springs you don't fool with. These are springs that if you try to paddle upstream, you can't do it in many cases because there's so much flow coming at you out of the ground. Just go through the dry woods and all of a sudden there's this water rising up out of the ground. It's like a miracle when you really think about it. Where's this water coming from? Well, that water is coming from a very large what we call a spring shed. Instead of a watershed, a spring shed is the area where recharge, either from rainfall or runoff, goes into the groundwater to feed a certain spring. And we can map out spring sheds, and we have there. All of North Florida is divided up into spring sheds. It's contiguous. It's about 27 million acres of North Florida, about two-thirds of the state, recharges the water that comes out of our aquifer. And that water naturally comes out of springs. Just I'll give you a little bit about the biology before I get into the how humans have changed that whole hydrologic picture. We have a cave fauna that's unique. We have numerous rare and endangered species of flying animals, crayfish, copepods, fish that live in the Florida aquifer. It's pitch black there. It's if you've ever been in a cave and turned all the lights off, you know what black is. It's in the realm of no light at all. And so there's a whole fauna that's developed and that actually moves around in the aquifer. And they're captured in people's wells. They're captured by cave divers. We have a very large group of cave divers in Florida, thousands of people that come to Florida to dive in the underground aquifer. And they are fearless explorers, always looking for new caves to explore and mapping caves. We have some caves that have been mapped out over 30 miles of underground passageways by cave divers that who go into the ground for more, sometimes more than 30 hours at a time underwater. Incredible, and to depths as great as 400 feet in the aquifer. So what we know is that there is a fauna, not a flora, there's no life down there, but there are bacteria that can grow in the underground groundwater. So our groundwater under natural conditions is the purest water we have in Florida. When it comes out at the surface, you can see further through this water than you can in the alpine lakes of the High Sierras, the lakes in Switzerland, Lake Tahoe, Lake the greatest crater lake in Oregon. These are the clearest lakes, and the springs are as clearer than those lakes because the water has been filtered through sand and limestone. And so it has no particulate matter, almost unmeasurable particulate matter, other than these organisms. So it's very pure, except that it's picked up lime by the dissolution of the limestone. So there's calcium carbonate is the chemical formula for limestone. And that is dissolving, like I said, in response to the low acidity of rainfall. Rainfall has carbon dioxide solubilized in it, and that lowers the pH of rainfall. So it's slightly acidic, and the limestone's constantly dissolving, and that's what's forming the caves. That's what's forming sinkholes. Florida is very famous for sinkholes. We have tens of thousands of sinkholes in Florida, and new ones forming all the time. So there's this honeycomb of groundwater. It's mostly inert. There can be bacteria in it, depending on where the water is coming from. There typically isn't, but as more and more as we recharge our wastewaters, our waters from farms, our waters from animal feedlots, we're getting bacteria in the groundwater, and we're getting nutrients in the groundwater. And that can grow. The bacteria can actually prosper in the groundwater in the dark under low oxygen conditions by utilizing nitrate nitrogen, which is a anthropogenic pollutant that's in our aquifer. But there really isn't any life in the aquifer other than very rare cave fauna. When that water sees the light of day, it's got enough nutrients, even under natural conditions, there's enough nitrogen and phosphorus. It's at a constant temperature because it's been underground. And so our springs, the water in our springs is roughly at the average annual air temperature for wherever that spring is. So in the Gainesville area, which is where I'm located, and High Springs is located where our Springs Welcome Center is, the temperature is about 72 degrees Fahrenheit. So year round, in the coldest day in winter, when it's 25 or 30 degrees, the water's 72 degrees. And in the summer, when the water is up to 90 degrees, the spring 72 degrees. So it's just amazing chemical or chemostat in terms of water quality, water quantity, water clarity. And so when the water sees the light of day under natural conditions, the springs put forth incredible plant communities, very adapted plant communities, and communities of animals that have adapted to live with those plants. And in fact, based on the earliest research in springs, which the first exhaustive research was by Howard Odom, who we named the Springs Institute after, who was my major professor when I was at the University of Florida. The plant productivity is as high as any of the great ecosystems in the world, the tropical rainforest, the coral reefs. The productivity is incredibly high because of the water clarity, the sunlight we have for as a semi-tropical to temperate climate, but we get a lot of sunlight. And the fact that there's water, that's all life usually needs is water and nutrients. And we have that in abundance at our springs. So the springs under natural conditions have flourish and beautiful plant communities, waving grasses, beautiful plants like coontail and myriophyllum and sago pondweed and things like that naturally grow in these systems. Those then form the basis for food chain, which I said is highly adapted. It is. The food chain starts out with microalgae, basically diatoms, living, grazing the leaves of the plant. We call it the good algae they're grazing. That's the diatoms. And the algae is grazing that, and then it's fed on by small microscopic insect larvae, especially midge larvae, and a whole variety of other insects that have an aquatic phase. And those then are the food for the whole food chain for the fish and the crayfish and the turtles and, of course, the birds and the alligators that live in a natural spring. And our springs are full of this beauty and have a very, very lovely ecosystem to start with in natural systems. So that's a sort of a picture of what they look like. And as people come to Florida and see springs for the first time, they're still beautiful. The water is still, in many of our springs, water is absolutely clear still. You can see 300 feet through the water, which is a remarkable distance to see through water. And you can see the plants, you can see the fish, you can see the beauty of these springs, like the Itchinatuckney that you so almost correctly pronounced in Silver Springs, and a number of our springs still have these beautiful plant communities. And that's why springs are loved. But even when you first see a spring, it's a work of art, just because the water and its natural state is blue. It appears blue because blue wavelength travels the furthest through water. So it's the only wavelength that's left by the time you look at a spring. And it's blue for that reason.
So before we go further, I have one more ecology question here, which is, maybe this is silly, but a lot of prey creatures especially require, I mean, they hide. This seems, if the water is so clear, how has that changed various animal relationships in terms of the ability to hide? Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, I'm an ecologist of, like you said, 40 years. It's totally an adapted community. In other words, the insects don't try to hide from the fish that are eating them. I mean, they are small enough that the fish just go along and pick them off, like an appetizer. The insects themselves are feeding on diatoms, which can move around but never flee from a predator that's about to eat them. They basically are like sheep grazing in a pasture, and just the way grass doesn't run away from a sheep, the diatoms don't run away from the insect. And then the fish, like I said, catch these. Now, there are different sized fish, and it's just amazing sometimes when you're swimming down through one of these springs. We we do this regularly with a mask and a snorkel or with scuba. We go underwater to observe the life, and you'll see a fish just immobile. They'll just be like a gar fish, for example, which is a top predator in springs, 4 or 5 feet long, just immobile, just waiting. And they're basically, their prey is not paying attention, and they'll dart out and grab something when they see it. Same thing with alligators. Alligators are just stay immobile until something makes a false move, and then they suck it up right away. And that's true with bass and a lot of the top predators in the spring. Otherwise, we have herbivores like turtles. We have incredible diversity of turtles. We have one of the highest diversities in our springs and our rivers of Florida. That's higher than just about any place in the world. It's like the second highest in the world. So we have these turtles that are herbivores, and they're munching the plants all the time. And in doing that, what we found, what Dr. Odom found, and what I confirmed in my research, is that the animals that are what we call consumers, that are preying on other things, are actually directing the whole orchestra. They're munching, and their predation is what sets the next level lower in the food chain to the proper level, so that there's the right number of fish, there's the right number of turtles, there's the right number of insects, and the overall system actually maximizes productivity as a result of the natural evolution that's occurred in spring. These are, well, I compare them to finely tuned automobiles. They're like finely tuned Lamborghinis when they're healthy, and they're running beautifully without any help from humans, of course. And they're running beautifully to maximize their overall productivity and the number of fish, number of turtles, number of alligators, number of birds. These things are maximized in a healthy spring.
That always makes me happy to hear things like that. I love that stuff. And one small thing before we go to what people have done to the springs is, I have a friend who's a fisheries biologist who, we were sitting by the ocean one day, and he happened to mention that sharks have the perfect roughness of skin to minimize drag as they swim at speed. And I know the guy goes to church, so I asked him, do you believe in some sort of intelligent design? And he responded, there is great intelligence in time. And I love that, you know, these springs have been there for, did you say 20 million years?
30 for the whole limestone aquifer. The springs probably haven't fully been around, maybe 10 million or so, but it's been a long time they've been evolving. And remember, it was under the ocean many times. Or, you know, when the ice caps melt, which they're currently doing, Florida goes under the ocean. In fact, all of Florida has been under the ocean periodically throughout prehistory. And so it wasn't during those times that the springs were in existence. The aquifer was full of salt water during those events. But as sea levels fell, as the ice caps formed, sea levels fell, just about 15,000 years ago, sea levels were 300 feet lower. 300 feet lower. Florida was twice as wide as it is now. It was another 100 miles to the coast going west to the Gulf Coast. And that was all habitable land with springs and animals, you know, and extinct, what are extinct megafauna now. And people were living out there. But the springs were here because there was rainfall. And one thing I want to point out, one other natural thing that's part of the miracle of springs, is the fact that we have this high rainfall in Florida. And why is that? We're at approximately 30 degrees north latitude. And if you know your mariner jargon, that's the horse latitudes. And that's the latitudes where all the deserts in the world are around 30 degrees north latitude because of this persistent blowing wind that basically blows moisture away. And so the southwestern deserts of the United States, the deserts, the Sahara deserts, the Gobi Desert, the deserts of China, are all roughly at the same latitude as Florida. So why isn't Florida a desert? And in some ways Florida is, but Florida is an island in the desert. Our Florida is an island in the ocean, and we're not a desert because we're only about 100 miles wide, and the convective storms coming off the Gulf of Mexico, instead of dumping the rain on the Pacific Crest Mountains, they dump it here on Florida, and Florida gets a pretty high average rainfall because of that. It's only because we have that much rain that we have such big spring. If the rainfall changes, if it goes up because of sea level rise or if it goes down, well, our springs will change. And in fact, we have dry years here. Florida, like I said, is at the horse latitude. And some years our rainfall is as low as 35, 36 inches. Well, we're also semi-tropical, and so our evapotranspiration is that high. During those years, there's essentially no net recharge of rain to the aquifer. And water is coming out of the aquifer all the time in the springs. The springs are flowing even during these drought periods, at least they used to. So the water balance is really important in Florida. We have just a vast amount of water that falls on Florida and comes in from up north in Georgia. And then that's why we have so many springs and all the rivers and wetlands we have.
So can you talk, can you give us a history of, say, the last 150 years of the ecological damage that has occurred? And one reason I go back that far is I can't remember the name. I'm sure you know the name. There's this guy who wrote a book, I don't know, 1900, 1890, 1910, about how wonderful the ecology of Florida was and how it was getting hammered. Do you know who I'm talking about? He's a pretty famous guy.
There's one called Florida, Florida Eden. And then, yeah, there's a book like that. I can't remember the author of that book, but I mean, I'll take you back. You know, William Bartram and his father traveled through Florida in the 1770s, and they described the springs, and they interacted extensively with the Seminoles who had moved into Florida during Spanish rule of Florida. You know, Spaniards colonized Florida initially in the mid-1500s and started building missions and wiping out the native people, and eventually the Creeks moved into Florida, the Yamasees from South Carolina, and the Seminoles were formed during that time. But Bartram traveled with them, and at that time, the Indians lived near the springs. Of course, there were water, and all the I'm an amateur archaeologist, and all of the archaeological sites are near water. People need water to survive, and so all the springs were occupied. In fact, there are extensive mounds, Indian mounds, at many of the springs, especially the ones along the St. John's River, which had mounds all along it. But a number of our major springs have substantial mounds, or the mounds have been removed over time for roadkill. But those springs have always been a place where people lived. And in fact, we recently completed an archaeological dig here in North Florida on the Santa Fe River by a spring, and I led that, and we found that people, very likely people have been here more than 25,000 years ago, 10,000 years longer than is commonly reported. But we found OSL, optically stimulated luminescent dates going back at least 25,000 years and maybe longer, with cultural artifacts. They weren't the Clovis people. They were way before the Clovis people, making simpler artifacts, but living, had a good economy, and obviously living along all our water bodies at that time. So people have been around springs a long time. And if you go back 150 years, you just about can't see any impacts to the spring. And I've done that. I've written a recent book about the Santa Fe River and its springs. And it's just in the last 90 years that we've really been messing with the springs and with groundwater, and in the last 50 years that we've really harmed them. So it's a recent phenomenon. It's accelerating over time, unfortunately, as development accelerates. And you know, Florida is receiving about 1,000 people, a net increase of about 1,000 people every day in Florida are populating the state of Florida, so that all our problems related to humans are accelerating. So the first issues on springs were visited, like I said, by William Bartram in the 1770s. They're written about extensively in the 1850s. Harriet Beecher Stowe came to Florida. Ulysses S. Grant came to Florida. Mary Todd Lincoln came to Florida. People were coming to Florida as an exotic jungle to visit in the 1850s, before the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, a lot of it was fought around the springs, but after the Civil War, tourism really picked up, and we had a riverboat line, the Hart Line, coming out of Jacksonville. People would get to Jacksonville either by train or by schooner, and then take a riverboat from Jacksonville up the St. John's River, which is going south. It's one of those upside-down rivers, like the Nile, and then up the Ocklawaha River, which is the biggest tributary of the St. John's River, and then up the Silver River, which is the biggest tributary to the Ocklawaha River. Silver River is 100% spring flow, and it's from Silver Springs. The Silver Springs at that time was the largest spring in the whole world, in the United States. Also, in terms of measured flow, it was 500 million gallons a day coming out of one spring on average for about 100 years of measurement. So this place was discovered a long time ago, and people wrote about the springs. Springs became very important in terms of a form of the rivers, and the springs were the main transportation into the heart of Florida. It was the darkest heart of Florida. To get to Silver Springs by riverboat was a real adventure. And these little riverboats going up the narrow Ocklawaha River, they were described as like sleeping in a coffin, and some of them turned into coffins, but they would go at night through the jungle and eventually come out to this amazing Silver Springs, a very large head spring at Silver Springs, several acres, and you're out in the sunlight again. And there was a hotel there, and the cultural history is amazing. But that really changed. Silver Springs was discovered. Several of the springs were, by the late 1800s, we had some health spa springs in Florida. White Sulphur Springs in North Florida had 14 hotels, and railroad coming to it. Railroad from Jacksonville came over to some of our springs over in this area. Worthington Springs had a hotel and had swimming, and there were really big attractions in the springs at that time. But it was in the 1920s that the glass bottom boat was invented, actually the late 1800s. And then by the 1920s, glass bottom boats were very popular. And the first big developments on Silver Springs started. They started making movies at Springs. So they made Tarzan and Creature from the Black Lagoon. And 40 or 50 movies were made at Silver Springs. So they became really well known. And then by the 1940s, ABC Corporation bought Silver Springs, and Silver Springs got up to 1 million visitors a year during that time before Disney World. And ABC actually had Silver Springs when I was doing my research there in the 70s. They finally sold it, but and it started its decline in the 60s. But the springs, and it wasn't just Silver Springs. There was Wickiewaches Springs, there was McCullough Springs, there was Homosassa Springs. All these springs had major tourist attractions. And they had mermaids at Wickiewaches. They had a water skiing elephant at Ponce de Leon Springs in Volusia County. There were two different elephants who were trained to ride on water skis, and they would pull them around in the spring run below the spring. And that spring was turned into a sugar mill before the Civil War. It was destroyed during the Civil War, and it was rebuilt. And now it's a pancake house where the mill wheel's turning. You can make your pancakes at your table at Ponce de Leon Springs. And it turned the spring into a swimming pool. It's surrounded by a sidewalk now. And nice ladies go and pull out the plants every day that are trying to grow in the bottom of the spring. It's a very sad sight. So things really started changing for the springs then, but they still weren't really damaged because we weren't using that much groundwater. Well, that changed right around the end of the 19th century, they started putting wells into the ground in Jacksonville and Southeast Georgia for industry. And the wells were free flowing. There was enough pressure in the aquifer at that time of like a full balloon. And they started putting pinpricks in it, and that started lowering the pressure in the aquifer. But at first, the wells were all, they didn't have pumps. The water just flowed freely. And they put more and more wells in until they reduced the pressure. So the pressure in the aquifer was more than 40 feet above the land surface around 1900. It's about 40 to 60 feet below the land surface now. And of course, Jacksonville has a saltwater intrusion in some of its wells. And they keep pumping more and more water out of that, the same aquifer that we're all using here. And it wasn't just Jacksonville. It's every city in Gainesville. All of North Florida relies on the Florida aquifer for its water supply. So I estimate there's currently almost 1 million wells in the Florida aquifer. That's a million pinpricks in this balloon that used to supply about, in Florida, about 10.5 billion gallons a day of flow. For the 1,090 springs. The water balance data and analysis we've done indicates that fully a third of that flow is gone now and has been captured by human wells. About 3 to 4 billion gallons a day is being pumped on an average basis in Florida from the same aquifer. So, and just as a first note, that has just really accelerated since the 1950s as people have been putting in more wells, people have been putting in water bottling plants, farmers have been putting in irrigation systems using center pivot irrigation systems. And if you look at an aerial photo of North Florida now, you'll see hundreds of these center pivot irrigation systems, very similar to the Ogallala aquifer in Nebraska and Kansas. We're depleting our aquifer just right as we speak, and the springs are suffering from that terrible decline in their flows.
You mentioned earlier nutrient infiltration. So is that a small problem or is that a bigger problem?
It's a very big problem in areas of the state where the aquifer is vulnerable. The state, the geology of Florida is mixed. Like I said, there's a limestone platform under the whole state. But on that platform, there were various erosional layers that were laid down over time. The limestone actually is a number of different limestones that were laid down at different times over the last 30 million years. But even more recently, in the last 10 million years, 5 million years, we've had the erosion from even the Appalachian Mountains as they eroded, formed layers over the limestone. And that has, with rising and falling sea levels, that those surfaces have eroded away to different extents. So I'd say about a fourth of the state is highly vulnerable because it's just sand over limestone. In other words, there's really nothing protecting. There's no clay or impervious surface protecting what goes into the limestone. So in those pervious areas, those highly vulnerable areas, that's where most of our agriculture lives in North Florida. And now agriculture is responsible for about 80% of the nitrogen contamination of the Florida aquifer. And the whole Florida aquifer in the unconfined areas is contaminated with nitrate nitrogen at levels that are harmful to springs, but also in many cases harmful to humans. Now, we not only have agriculture, we have over 2 million septic tanks. Private domestic wastewater systems in Florida, 2 million. And that's probably about 5 million people that are basically putting their waste almost directly into the groundwater. We have, of course, 22 million people in Florida, and that waste from those people goes, a large part of it goes to wastewater treatment plants, which remove some of the nitrogen, but not all the nitrogen. And so that water usually is disposed of, a large part of it's disposed of to the ground, because we have very sensitive surface water bodies that we want to avoid polluting. So it ends up being about 400 million pounds a year of nitrogen is being loaded. And there's about 40 million pounds a year of nitrogen that's actually in the groundwater that's coming out of the wells and the springs. And that is at various concentrations depending on where you are. If you're in an area that's highly vulnerable, you're drinking water that has a significant amount of nitrogen in it. If you're in an area where it's the well field or your well, your private well is not in a vulnerable area, the nitrate levels are very low. But most of the springs are coincidental with the vulnerable area. So the majority of our springs, over 80% of our springs are above the state's standard for nitrogen. In other words, they're polluted by nitrogen and they're getting worse.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and there's two topics that I want to still address. One of them is to step away from the deplete to ignore aquifer depletion for a moment. Are there efforts to simply protect the habitat around many of these springs to stop the sort of swimming poolization of them?
There certainly are, and we have a long history of springs being taken into state parks. We have 16 state parks that are named after the springs that they're in: Silver Springs State Park, Weequahatchee State Park, Wekiva State Park, Homosassa State Park. So we have all these state parks, and many of them include up to thousands of acres of land around the springs. They definitely have the ability to protect the resource, the surface water resource, and the biology immediately around the springs. There's two problems with that. One is none of them have a limit on recreation other than the size of the parking lot. And so many of our springs are totally trampled, and they have been turned into swimming pools. Some of our nicest springs, that's true. Our newest spring state park is right here on the Santa Fe River near our Springs Welcome Center called Gilchrist Blue Spring. And it's a play spring. You know, it's a place where it's shallow enough, you can wade around. And so there's no natural vegetation growing in that spring. It's a dead spring in terms of the ecology of the spring. Downstream, it's got a run that they've limited walking now. So that is recovered to a fairly nice system. So we've got those springs. We have many springs that are in private ownership, where there's really no restrictions other than the state decides to enforce the law or not enforce the law in terms of pollution. But the state has not done a good job of enforcing the law, so that even our springs and our state parks are polluted with nitrate. In fact, some of the highest ones are, we recently completed a study on the Suwannee River Springs for state parks, Lafayette Blue, Troy Springs, Fanning Springs, and Manitou Springs. And three of those springs are essentially dead from pollution and from depletion, and yet they're state parks, and they're not very attractive anymore under most conditions. And that's because the Suwannee River is right in the middle of the agricultural belt in North Florida, where it's unconfined and where we have really horrific amount of groundwater use and groundwater pollution. So just flow aside, the other aspect is you can't protect the spring by buying it. For example, Silver Springs, they've got 5,000 acres. They own the complete Silver Springs, the Silver River, and 5,000 acres. And the spring itself is less tributes water and nutrients to the spring. It's 1 million acres. And that area is 90% of it or more is privately owned, and a large part of that's in agriculture. So Silver Springs has lost roughly 30 to 40% of its historic flow. The formerly the largest spring in the world in terms of flow is now second to Rainbow Springs, and has lost a significant amount of its flow, which has really hurt its ecology. Still a beautiful spring, still has a beautiful plant community, but it's got high nitrate levels and it's lost its lifeblood, a lot of its lifeblood, so that during drought periods, it's really sick. It turns even green itself. It's a beautiful spring. Nobody's buying the spring shed. The only springs that were the spring shed, the area that feed the spring, are protected, are in the Ocala National Forest. those springs, the spring shed is not fertilized and it's not depleted of groundwater use. So those springs actually are healthy from that standpoint. I do want to talk about what we can do about these problems real quickly, if I can.
Yeah, that was going to be my last question.
Jump into that. Yeah, these problems are totally solvable. They're solvable by a state government that doesn't favor industry and agriculture over the people. The water in Florida is, unlike the Western water laws, water in Florida is owned by all the people of Florida. It's a public resource. It's supposed to be protected, quantity and quality. And yet the state has given out 30,000 large permits for over 100,000 gallons a day of extraction. That's enough water for 1,000 people. They've given out permits to individual corporations for 30,000 of them. And that is the largest part of our flow reduction is due to those permits. The other thing we need to do is really cut back on outside irrigation. And that can be done. About 1/4 of the depletion of the water in the springs is due to people irrigating their grass outside. So we're growing grass with the same water that we should be growing our springs. The overall arching solution is to put a price on water, a price that everybody pays. Everybody must monitor their groundwater, not their surface water, but their groundwater. We need to put a price on it and then turn up that price, call it an aquifer protection fee, turn it up enough so that people reduce their water consumption. And that, of course, industry doesn't want that. Farmers don't want that. But that is the best solution. We have the tragedy of the common written large here. The aquifer is available to everybody. Anybody can put a well in on their property. And people do. Like I said, there's 1 million of them. And anybody can take pretty much as much water as they want, regardless of those permits. The other thing we need to do is put a cap on how much nitrogen fertilizer we allow in the state of Florida. It's a certain amount of it's showing up in our groundwater and we're drinking it. And it's actually toxic if you drink enough of it. So those are the two main things we need to do is put a aquifer protection fee on nitrogen and one on water use. And one last thing I want to say is the Springs Institute's really doing everything we can on every level, at the state level, at the science level, at the education level, to turn this around. And we have an initiative right now to turn the whole Springs region into a national heritage area. There's a growing number of these around the country. It's under the National Park Service, but there's no land taken by the federal government for this. It's a designation to raise awareness about the importance of an area. It's cultural history, it's natural history, it's biological history. And so we're actively working on that right now. We're developing the feasibility study for that right now that'll soon be going to the National Park Service. And what that does would allow a nonprofit like the Florida Springs Institute to have some matching funds from the federal government to further advertise and educate all the cities that are, their economies are based on the springs. We have 1 million people just going through High Springs to go recreate in Springs every year. High Springs is a tiny little town. It's the main business. We have cave divers. We have kayakers. We have canoers. We have swimmers. 1 million people a year to tune about $100 million a year in the economy of little High Springs in the area immediately around it. And overall, the Springs are generating at least $1 billion of direct income in the state of Florida. So we're killing the goose that's laying the golden egg by being short-sighted, and our government needs to turn this around. It can't happen by the people alone, but the people, if enough people raise their voices, the government can change it.
Well, thank you. And one last thing, which is, can you give the website for people to find out more about Florida Springs Institute?
Yeah, we have a number of websites, but our main one is floridaspringsinstitute.org. We have a blue water audit website about that project where we quantify the footprint, both the nitrogen and water footprint for the whole Springs region, 27 million acres, about 400,000 properties. And then we have floridasprings.org, which is an informational website. But Florida Springs Institute FloridaSprings.org is loaded with information about Florida Springs in terms of, and we have the Florida Springs Welcome Center in High Springs, which is our headquarters now, where we have our offices. We have an interpretive center there. We have classrooms there, and we're doing events all the time to raise awareness about Springs.
Well, thank you so much for being on the program, and thank you especially for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dr. Robert Knight. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.